With these verses, the hymn seems to have become impenetrable. Perhaps the narrative is suggesting that one begins to desire as a result of its creative heat. Desire and heat are often associated with one another. Desire is the seed of thought, the beginning of the process by which the world is brought into being. Just as we think we might be seeing some clarity, the song introduces poets. I believe it was Shelley who said that poets are the unacknowledged legislators of the world. But even Shelley did not imagine such a grand role for poets in the world's creation. These poets, however, are more than just wordsmiths. They are sages, saints, and philosophers as well. Yet where they came from and what role they play in the world's creation is not clear. Some commentaries have suggested that the hymn maintains that the poets bring that one into existence through their meditative powers. Others think that the poets merely discern the structure of existence through wisdom after the world's creation. Then, rather surprisingly, the hymn takes an unexpected turn. After making these pronouncements, it becomes profoundly humble. Who really knows? Who will here proclaim it? Whence was it produced? Whence this creation? The gods came afterwards with the creation of this universe. Who then knows from whence it has arisen? Whence this creation has arisen? Perhaps it formed itself, or perhaps it did not. The one who looks down upon it in highest heaven, only he knows, or perhaps he does not know. There's something refreshingly honest about these concluding verses. Without reaching a point of cynicism or nihilism, it merely reminds us that such thoughts about the origin of the cosmos remain speculative. From the beginning, we are enveloped in a mystery. Other creation stories from the Veda are not always so modest in their conclusions. These stories develop other creation themes that have parallels in many other cultures. These hymns indicate that the world came into being through a cosmic egg, the union of sky and earth, the ritual dismemberment, as we shall see later on, of a primordial giant. There are about 20 different Sanskrit words for the English word God. The most commonly used word is deva. The word deva means shiny and exalted. A deva is a divine being or a supernatural power, but not necessarily an omniscient or an omnipotent being. Devas are not moral exemplars, nor are they lawgivers like Yahweh or Allah in the Western monotheistic traditions. Because they were created after the world's creation, they, the devas, are subject to its laws, including the law of Rita. By tradition, the Veda is said to mention the existence of 33 different devas. These devas dwell in different parts of the Trilaka, and most of them have specific divine functions associated with the fundamental concerns of the Aryans. Nature gods, for example, addressed anxieties concerning floods, droughts, and agriculture. War gods respond to threats from outside the community. Other gods help preserve internal communal stability by enforcing compliance with Rita. Some devas have more than one function, such as Agni, who is both a god of fire and the mediator between humans and the gods. We haven't the time, of course, to discuss the entire pantheon of the Vedic gods, nor is it necessary, really, since some are more important than others. But to give you a flavor of the range of Vedic theology, let me acquaint you with a few of the more interesting primary devas.